Take 4, Side 1, National Conference of Jewish Women's Oral History. We are interviewing Leon Arkus in his office, July 20th, 1992. Mildred Menlo with her partner, Ruth Weiner.
Finally, we changed into reprinting the article. But the strangest thing is, whoever wrote the headline had discovered some things which the reviewer had said it was not this, it wasn't that. And that's why using those phrases as a laudatory rather than condemnatory thing, you see. And the headlining of the thing was the most negative statement I ever heard, or rather ever read. It was absolutely destructive and irrelevant to the entire review. Harry Schwab, then one of the writers here on it, said this, he couldn't understand how this could have ever been said, wrote a letter to the editor, I didn't know about it until it was printed, condemning this, saying it was the outstanding review we've ever had, and so on. There was a good deal of flack. No reply from anybody. I just let it go. Bill knew I was burnt up about it, and damn rightly, I had a good reason for it. You don't do a year's work to have some stupid headline writer do this to you. At any rate, there was an occasion where there was a very large to-do at the Institute, and everybody was in an architectural hall there. There must have been about quite a few hundred, and all our patrons and all that. And in the middle of it, I was right there with Jim Walton at that time, and Bill Block walked up and apologized. And I said, Bill, and I meant very loudly, Bill, you don't owe me an apology at all. You owe it to Pittsburgh, because that's been your action all the way through. You've condemned your own city to a tank town mentality. And Bill was a little upset, but anyway, there was applause. And that's what it was done for. And I don't think Bill's ever forgiven me, but damn it all, he got it. Good. I'm not afraid for saying
that. And
like
it was true.
It was true. Because you want to know something? That's exactly what's true.
That's true.
It's been he has always condemned any progressive thing. He goes along with so far and then condemns it. As a matter of fact, the Post-Gazette has become a very decidedly anti-Semitic rag. And let's face it, John Craig is certainly not a friend of the Jews.
No.
So I don't give a darn whether they start up again or not. Unfortunately, I hate to think of this paper as city only under one paper, and that a reactionary sheet like the Scripps Howard Press.
That's terrible.
But that's, I don't know. I think the elections will change things.
I hope.
Let's see, what do you want to talk about now?
Let me finish this up, though. So since Charlie Rosenblum, there has not been another Jew.
Oh, since there have been a lot of Jews put on, but it all came on in later years. Oh, let's see. I wish I had a... I don't have any of the recent... There's Fine.
Milton.
Milton Fine. There's Gumberg's wife.
Marcia.
No. There's, unfortunately, James Winokur. Milton Porter. I'm sure there are a couple more. There's also... There are two kinds of trustees. There's a term trustee and a one that's
elected life trustee. And young spire, Alex, is a term. I'm sure there are a number of Jews, but it has changed radically because Jim Walton, I must say, is quite a realist and realized that if the museum were to go on, if the Institute were to continue, it needed Jewish support. One of the factors there, and it's a man I never knew, but Avinoff, who was the director of the Natural History Museum for many years, would not allow Jews into his office. Did you know that?
No.
You wouldn't speak to him.
There are many, many Jewish women active in the auxiliaries, docents and things of that sort at the museum now.
Well, we opened it very, there are a lot of women in our women's association,
that's
a group, that were Jews, yes. And there was nothing like that there. But then again, that was under Gordon Washburn, that was controlled by us, not by the trustees, you see. And that's an entirely different thing. But, I'll never forget, I'll give you a very good example. There was a chap named Ted Condeman. He's dead now, so I can speak about him. His wife's still alive. Ted had married into the Oliver family out in Sewickley and gotten along, you know, into this sort of echelon. I don't know where he originally came from. He was an insurance man. And as the son-in-law at that time, I think son-in-law, of one of the presidents of Carnegie Institute, I forget which one, got the account of insuring Carnegie Institute. I don't have to tell you what that meant. That got him an enormous sum of money. It's not only the billing, it's the collections and everything else. I was invited over to the Condiments once with several others where there are a number of trustees involved. And the conversation led by Ted got into the subject of billboards. And of course, to which I expressed my dismay. I don't like billboards any more than anyone else does. And I must say, I'm all in favor of Eleanor Roosevelt's campaign against them, and actually, what's her name? Mrs. Mondale, who, by the way, was a good friend of ours here. She used to come down to our openings. At any rate, but then, as Ted pointed out very blithely, that after all, it was a Jewish operation, meaning the Posners. And at that moment, I expressed great shock. That the various people like General Motors and all the other people that were advertising on billboards were Jewish.
Oh!
You see, and this sort of created a little bit of an undercurrent. But I was walked away from that dinner very angry, intensely angry. And I vowed to get Ted. He was going to hear about this. Damn, I'm not going to stand by and watch and listen to this sort of nonsense. At any rate, I had my opportunity 2 weeks later. He was operating through a firm named Fred S. James here. And they had pulled, I know, some mistake made, and our controller's office got all upset about it and all that. And I said, look, why don't we cack it up to date? You haven't had any bids on this thing for years and years. Why not bring in a number of companies? There are special people in this field, like Huntington Block and Washington and others, who have specialized in art insurance. And we're really silly. And we're paying an awful fee.
Well, there was a little bit of, you know, hesitancy, because we always support our own there, you know, is the always way you have to figure this. But at any rate, I made so much of a issue of this thing, they couldn't very well not go through with it. So we did. And this time, I had discovered through my secretary, Emily, who was a fantastic gal, how Ted always managed things. He would always throw in a thing like, oh, we'll give you free insurance on war risks. And things that were absolutely useless. And so I gave a specific number of things, specifically what we wanted. We wanted to know what the terms were, but these were the only things. If you threw in anything else, it didn't matter. You're not going to be judged on that. And sure enough, Ted lost. And we got another firm here, local firm, and later we got blocked. But Ted lost his entire income. It was a terrible blow. It's funny. He lives right across the street from me. But I'm damned. He's dead now. And he was an alcoholic, and he finally ran away from his wife, and she's still there. But I'm not going to get into all of that. The point of the matter was, I think this is the best way to catch. You want to catch anybody in the situation, you want to be anti-Semitic, fine. Do without our money.
Yeah. More than one way to skin a cat.
His name with a C or a K, Condiman. How do you spell it?
C-O-N-D-E-R-M-A-N. No, I'm just kidding. This is,
yeah.
We're little things like that. I think we gradually turned them around.
What?
There are a lot of things. There's an awful lot of things you just had to turn away from. Some of it was stupidity. I don't think probably either of you had ever met Roy Hunt Sr., had you? Incredible. This man had inherited from his father, who founded Alcoa, had inherited, he and the Arthur Vining Davis group had got Alcoa, and he was chairman of the board. And all he would do all day is look at everybody's figures and add them up, make sure they were correct. He did a longhand too, he used a calculator. This was, and Hunt was a horror. There's many famous stories about Hunt, one of which was, he went to the Episcopalian church over here regularly every Sunday, and one day one of the parishioners got a hold of him outside and said, "Look, Mr. Hunt, everybody here knows that you're one of the wealthiest men in this country. Why is it you never give any money to charity?" Hunt was astonished that anybody would dress him this way. And somebody says, "Well," he says, "that's very simple. I have four sons, three of whom are married. I have children, grandchildren. Has it ever occurred to you one of them might get ill?" This is a story that really should be used for. No, I'm very serious. This is typical sort of. He really, really, really felt that he was gifted by God, because God let him be born unto wealth, into wealth. You see, this was his preordination and into the condition of society. And by the way, it's the thing that is, I think, fully believed by many of the people out in Swickley. They're God's gifts to the world.
I want to ask you about Mrs. Scaife.
Yeah. I can tell you a lot about her. My first not meeting with her, but rather my first upsetness.
Just one moment.
And it was upsetness. Came through a curator we had named Herbert Weisberger. Herbie was a wonderful human being. He's the one who set up our decorative arts department section of the museum. Now dead. At that time, an elderly man. And he could, actually charming. And he had sold Mrs. Scaife on funding his whole operation. But she made a statement to him, which actually blew both of us, blew our minds. She had made the statement, oh well, she didn't mind giving money if she didn't have to meet the people she gave it to. And I really, that sort of cynicism sort of got me down. It was much too much. Until, as I got to know her in later years, I must say I understood her, and it became quite a different thing. She was a woman, probably one of the saddest people I've known. I have a great affection for Mrs. Scaife. I should, after all, she made my career in a sense. She was a woman who only had been set up as a sort of the Princess of Pittsburgh, being a Mellon. Everybody bowed to her. Actually, I'll never forget the occasion when we showed her the first picture she bought. She had a little soiree of the so-called upper group of her friends. And when she walked in the room, many of the women actually almost curtsied. And she hated it. She hated this whole thing with a incredible hatred. She used to leave Pittsburgh for long spells. She took an apartment in the Carlisle in New York. She went on trips all the time with her husband, Alan, who predeceased her by quite a bit. In fact, she drank like a fish.
Was she knowledgeable about art?
No. Well, then, who was? there was an inherent decency in her. I will say this about even about her son Dick. In that whole group, I have never found 1 ounce of prejudice, which is interesting. Dick is not in the slightest degree anti-Semitic. In fact, if any, he doesn't care. It weren't for one of his advisors, he actually liked Negroes, blacks. There was none of this. And I'm really astonished. Mrs. Scaife. She'd go to the children's zoo, which, by the way, she secretly funded, and they would let her in. And she'd stay there with the children all day. She had built in out of Penguin Court, out of Ligonier, a doll's house, which really was her own house, reproduced into small furniture. Part of it's now on view at the museum, which I didn't want, but I had to, obviously.
The kids love it.
It's so unimportant, you know.
The kids like it,
yeah. They all like Walt Disney, too. at any rate, but my first excursion into the dealing with Mrs. Scaife was I was called in. We had no director. Washburn left. And von Groschwitz, who was hired, he was a relative of Mr. Roy Arthur Hunt. He was a print curator from Cincinnati. Von hadn't arrived on a scene, and they asked me to go and buy some paintings for Mrs. Scaife for the museum. And I went into New York and came back with 6 paintings. I did one of which I felt was an absolute masterpiece, and the others were damn good. And but it also gave me an indication what her taste would be. One of them was a soutine, which was pretty wild, and I assumed that she wouldn't buy it, but if she did like it, it would give me latitude, you see, to go even further. It was a wonderful soutine. It's too bad we never did get it. But at any rate, the first incident was, she looked at them all and went before a Renoir of a little girl, which was my least favorite, and but a good Renoir, and said, "I love this." And she went on, and I kept on saying, "Miss Gates, the greatest picture in New York right now is over here. It's by Degas. It's a woman about to take a bath." And she looked at it, and she said, "Yes, but I really love this." And then she saw the Vuillard, and she liked that very much. I forget the... and it boiled down to what was the other painting? Another painting involved. At any rate, well, I was worried because the Degas was a tremendous thing. It still is. And I wanted that picture in the worst way. And I kept on always dragging her back to it. And finally she looked at me and said, "You like that picture, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." And she waited a few moments thinking, and so I said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing. I want you to tell me when you like something. And you stick by your guns." He says, "I admire that, and I admire the fact that you kept on bringing me back always to that painting." He says, "Now we're going to buy these 4. I expected one. I probably collapsed. Well, I don't. That's my first experience with Mrs. Cape.
And did she include the Degas?
Oh yeah.
And the Soutine?
We have the Degas. We have the Vuillard. We have the Renoir. We have many, many others. But I mean, since then. But
yes.
This was the beginning gun. Did I only get 3? I don't remember. There's a full painting. I'm pretty positive. At any rate, time does tricks on your memory. Does tricks with your memory. At any rate, our relationship continued. She'd wanted more and more, and we got stuff in this fashion. Some of them, but I always felt I had the backing of Mrs. Scaife. Oh, yeah. She was there, and now it's very funny. There is another Renoir which I did not want. Von Groschwitz had found this Renoir called "It's 4 Nude Girls Playing with a Crab on the Beach." Now, our president was James Bavard. Bavard was an incredibly odd guy. I had a certain affection for him because while I may have called him a Squire Booby, he came out of Fielding, really. He really was an 18th century fox hunting squire out of England. I mean, this is the sort of mentality he had. He was very fair to people who worked with him. If you did something, he disapproved, he'd tell you, but he'd support you to the hilt, to everybody else. And I thought it tickled a lot of things about that. At any rate, but Bavard, who was quite a heller in his day, and I understand went to Yale with R.K. Mellon, and the two of them used to go on various escapades. At any rate, Bavard was very upset about nudes. And when this picture came up for Mrs. Gates to pass on, Bavard got up and said, "Now, Sarah," he said, "you cannot buy that picture." He said, "You know,
there are a lot of nudes now in the museum, and people are going to say all sorts of strange things about you. And he went on in that vein. And here was this woman, her hands were this way and all, and her voice was very, very quavery. Said, turned on him and said, "You know, Jim," she said, "you know what your trouble is? When you were a young man, you never went on escapades like this." It brought the whole place down. I couldn't help it. I just blew. It was the funniest statement I've ever heard. It just devastated me. And from that day on, Brevard never raised a single objection to anything we ever got. But what a put down.
Marvelous.
Oh, well. This is... So, she was quite a woman. I must say, I liked her immensely. And she really... She hated any form of... excessive bowing and scraping to the great Mrs. Gafe was something she ran like mad from. And there's a wonderful story told to me by, she had a woman named Margaret who was her companion, a much younger woman, who was really a fabulous gal. And Margaret once told me the story of how she and Mrs. Gafe went to New York, and it was Christmas time, just before Christmas. And at one point, Mrs. Gafe said, "Are you doing anything this evening?" And Margaret said, "Yes." She was going to go down and look at all the department stores in New York, see the Christmas displays. And she said, "How about coming with me?" And Mrs. Gafe said, "Well, she's a little tired. Maybe she should go to bed." And Margaret said, she was about to leave when Mrs. Gafe appeared, all dressed, saying, "I think I'll go with you." So they went and they got a cab, and they got this old black cabbie who talked a great streak, and they explained to him what they wanted, and he was wonderful. He stopped at every store and he said, "Now look, don't worry about anything. I can't park here. I'll meet you here in exactly so many minutes." And he went around and he did this all over.
Oh.
And he was wonderful to him. Well, the first thing you know, he and Mrs. Gafe became fast friends and she was got him. And you know, this is the richest woman in Pittsburgh and one of the richest women in America. Nonsense. She had no pretense, none of this nonsense. And she always spoke about this cabbie, what a wonderful man he was. And Margaret, she had a veneration for Mrs. Gafe, which was incredible. I must say, I had a great use for her. I'll never forget one incident where I brought back one painting, was a Degas of a racing scene. You know, he did race horses. His horses, by the way, are brilliant.
The Huntington Museum has a room full of Degas horses in Los Angeles, outside Los Angeles.
They're wonderful. Wonderful. Well, if you call Cézanne the greatest artist of the 20th century, then Degas would be that of the 19th. But those two are, to me, the great gods of painting. Then came Matisse. So I can go on with many stories about this, but this jockey scene. When the moment she saw it, she says, "Get that out of here." I never heard her use this sort of, you know, anger and upsetness. And then she said very apologetically, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that, but I can't stand racing scenes." Later I learned Dick, you know, had fallen from a horse and they had to put a plate in his head. And she never got over that, you see. So that's part of the problem.
Huh?
And you see, she was, in a lot of ways, a very concerned mother, a lot of things. She was basically a comparatively simple woman. And people were giving all these attributes. As Gordon Washburn put it, when he first came to Pittsburgh, he said, this is the only instance he ever heard of anybody taking their private yacht to Europe and being followed by their own plane. That's true. That's true. It's a good story.
That's marvelous.
Do they continue to be, the family continue to be supportive in Pittsburgh?
They were always very supportive. She was, yes.
Yes.
Well, she died at a certain point.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
When she died, Dick took over.
That's what I'm asking.
And continued. It was a little bit more difficult than dealing with her. She was... I'm giving you material that'll only come out after I'm gone,
yeah,
so I don't have to worry.
That's right.
But we amounted, I was buying about $8 million worth of art a year. You gotta realize that's a lot of money, especially in those days. And that's how we became a museum. We became a museum through Mrs. Gates.
And Dick is continuing?
Dick continued up to a point until that evil genius got a hold of him. I always say I'll never talk about them.
End of side one, take four. Continuing on side two.
I am
in all this and sold Dick on the idea of not giving money at all to the Carnegie and using it for